Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mysterious Topics Podcast. This is John, and along with me today is Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hey, John. How are you doing today?
Sean is our resident historian, who we talked to before about Pompeii and Herculaneum. And today we wanted to discuss basically the origins of the Crusades, and we'll probably try to get through the First Crusade today.
Yes, there's a lot to go through.
Yeah, there really is a lot to go through. And what we want to kind of do an overview. I mean, it's so detailed. There's so much information. There's another excellent podcast that Sean told me about, and I listened to some of it. It's History of the Crusades, right, Sean?
Yes, by Sharon Eastall.
Yeah, and that is a very excellent podcast that goes into great detail. Not just the First Crusade, it continues on with the other Crusades as well. So this is a period of time that went on for hundreds of years, actually, going back and forth. But I thought it would be it's a good subject to talk about because many of these issues are still going on today.
Yes, sadly.
Well, why don't we start out with just basically the origins of the First Crusade and how and why it happened.
So from my reading and attempts to learn more about the Crusade, the first idea that I see of the origins of the Crusades would have been the Reconquista, which was the attempts to try and take back the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslims in 800 AD.
Okay.
And that was kind of the first attempt where the Christians are trying to push back against the Muslim incursions. And that ends up going all the way to about, I think it was 1075 AD, to the point where Alphonse the VI, I believe it is, actually captures Toledo from the Muslims. And in this point in time as well, you have the Latin Church, which is the Western Church, and the Eastern Church, which is out of Constantinople, which is essentially the remaining part of the Roman Empire, that after the original Western Empire fell at the end of the 5th century, the Eastern Empire basically carried on the legacy of the Roman Empire for basically another almost 1,000 years.
Yes, they were known as the Byzantine Empire, correct?
Right. And so they were the Eastern Church. And what happened was about 1054, there was the Great Schism, which is basically the ideologies of the Western and the Eastern churches just became so divided that they just broke away from each other. And then there was an attempt to try and unite them, but because of the different issues that they couldn't resolve, you basically went with the Western Church and an Eastern Church. And there was a pope that came into power in the 1090s named Urban II, and he basically comes up with this idea after receiving a request from Alexius I, who is the emperor for Constantinople, asking for assistance because of an incursion of the Seljuk Turks in Anatolia, which is an area that has been under control of the Byzantine Empire, but the Turks have been moving west and they keep taking more and more territory, and basically they are representing the Muslim faith. And so they, at this point in time, have control of most of the Levant. And then there's another part of the Muslim called the Fatimid Empire, which is, it's another division of the Muslim faith because there's two versions. And so basically they cover the territory of, that includes Jerusalem. And so the idea is that Alexius I is trying to get help to try and reconquer the areas that they used to have under the Christian banner. And Urban II basically comes up with an idea that he's going to take the request for help that Alexius asks for and turn it into a movement, where the idea is, I'm not just going to send you some knights to help you. I'm going to organize all of Christendom, Western Christendom, to unite, stop killing each other and fighting each other all the time, and actually unite and focus on reclaiming Jerusalem and the Levant for Christianity.
Right. So Alexius is expecting, like you said, a few hundred knights to come and help his cause, and instead a population of people, including women and children too, right?
Yes, because what initially the Pope had wanted was just the knights and the noble class to get together. But what happens is you have a character named Peter the Hermit who ends up creating a people's crusade. So basically all the poor people decide that they're going to go on a holy crusade and cleanse their sins and reclaim Jerusalem. So you have not only the original requested crusade by the Pope, which is the nobles and the knights, but then you get this rabble of anywhere from 50 to 60,000 people who are going to go through Europe, through what is Turkey, and then down into the Levant area, which is, as I say, including Jerusalem, and reclaim it.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be having different groups, because within the noble class you're going to have different leaders from different regions, because you don't have the countries as we know them now. You still had basically everyone has different areas. So it's not France isn't a unified country at the time. So you have different groups within that, different areas coming to help. And so the thing is that you have thousands and thousands of people who haven't properly prepared their logistics that they need for a very, very lengthy journey. And that just causes all kinds of problems before they ever get even to Constantinople, which we can talk about.
Right. Well, it was said that as they were walking, as they were marching towards Constantinople, when the front of this envoy passed a particular point, it took 3 days until the end of it got there.
Yes. And you also have stories, because this becomes the period in which the first pogroms happen, which is basically the message was we have to get rid of the infidels out of Jerusalem, which is what they were talking about, the Muslim people. And then the regular people decide that that includes the Jewish people, because in their understanding of scripture, that the Jewish people were the one who put Jesus to death. So we have a bunch of Jewish people here. They have lots of money and property. So we should be able to get rid of them in the process. And that's a holy act. And so you basically start to have thousands of Jewish people murdered before they ever, as I say, get to Constantinople. So not even halfway to their actual journey. They're already having bloodlust. And
yeah. It's almost like everybody's kind of on their own tangent. It's almost becoming a mob scene on the way.
Yes.
Mentality.
And even aside from just the atrocities that occur there, you have the Christian people going to other Christian towns demanding supplies. And if the towns didn't give them supplies, they would sack the town. Because that's what ended up happening. I think it was in Belgrade, was they tried to sack the town and burn it. For an argument over something like shoes or something. And it's just, so I mean, it's just watching an idea just spiral out of control.
Yeah. And ill planned.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that the Pope quite understood what he was unleashing. And you can have questions of what his motivations may have been for why he came up with the idea to start. But I'm not sure that they ever had the expectation that just what would fall out from all of this.
Well, you know, that's the other thing we should briefly touch on, because as you said before, the fall of the Western Roman Empire in, what, around the 5th century, 6th century, somewhere in there, that kind of gave the popes a lot of power, because there was a big power gap at that point, correct?
Exactly. So what you started to have was the shift from, you know, with the Western Roman Empire, having your emperor, and then, you know, the rise of the church and, you know, the rise and fall and ebb of the church for a few hundred years. At the time of the fall of the empire, then you're starting to have kind of that the church is starting to become more of the power base, because they're providing more for the people. And then when you get the real shift in power was when you have Charlemagne come along and his basically instituting kind of the idea of the Pope, right? And so then you have from there, then you start having the different popes coming along and being a representative of God on earth. And again, you have the one that are set in Western Europe because they have different ideals and different ideas than the Eastern Europeans. And I mean, the Catholic Church in the Western Europe had been trying to stamp out different forms of Christianity that were coming up because you had different groups that had different ideas, and it's trying to get everyone to have one idea and then just go with that. And so then you have that, and that's where you end up getting such a diverse breakdown between the Eastern and Western churches and why they have such a hard time working together, because they're always at opposite agendas.
Yeah, and they're also completely separated. I think it's also important to note, as you're talking about them going towards Constantinople, if you were to look at a map of, it's now called Istanbul, it's a, especially at that time, very strategic location. It's on a little isthmus of land in Turkey, what is now Turkey. But at that time, that was really the only way to get to Western Europe, but
right,
without going all the way around the Black Sea or all the way around the Mediterranean, and you still have to cross the Mediterranean at some point.
Right, and basically because they're the gateway between the East and West, they're going to have control of trade and ideas, really, when you think about it. And then you're having the pushback because you keep having the migrations of the Turks from Asia who keep pushing further and further west. And of course, like anybody looking for territory, right, they're looking for a place to settle. They just happen to start coming against the Byzantine Empire. And then of course, you have with Muhammad and the rise of Islam in the 600s, that again, that's another group that pushes the Byzantines, what used to be an area that they had no problems controlling, basically pushing them back to where they're only left in Anatolia, which is part of, which is current day Turkey, and into Europe. So their control and their access to Asia keeps getting impeded further and further as you have the different groups rising. And so by the time that Alexius is requesting the assistance of the Western Church, you have the Seljuk Turks who have basically pushed them to the point back to Constantinople. And for instance, they had lost Antioch, which was a very important Christian city and had been part of the Roman Empire. So losing those cities was a huge loss. And so Alexius, it was very important to try and reclaim those because, of course, if you're trying to keep a power base, you have to be able to show that you can actually have and wield the power. And so whether it was just for religious reasons or political reasons, it's important for him to try and reclaim the lost territory and try and stem back the flow that the Seljuk Turks are creating, right?
Yes.
And then you have the idea in the Western Europe where everyone's fighting amongst each other. And as I say, the Pope's idea is set to, if we're going to focus the violence, let's focus the violence not against each other. And that Christ's words had been misunderstood about what you're allowed to do. And that basically, if you hurt someone who isn't a Christian, well, that's not evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's where you get this whole idea then, getting the crusade going and getting the groups together. And I mean, for a lot of the nobles that were involved in the crusade, whether it's Bohemond, who was a Norman Italian in southern Italy and Sicily, or Raymond, or Godfrey de Bouillon, these other guys who are, they're all looking for more land, more almost celebrity, if you will. And again, some of it could be considered pious as well. It's just all up for interpretation. But the point is that when you get it. These groups are coming together and they're looking for one thing, and that's to reclaim territory. And that's going to involve going to war with people. Now, the interesting part is if you look at prior to the crusading era, that really there was supposed to be a respect between the peoples of the book, whether it's Christian, the Judaism, the Jewish people, or the people of Islam. They all worship the same God. It's just different interpretations of who is divine and who is the messenger, but they're all supposed to have a respect for each other. And that just basically gets completely thrown aside.
Yes, it does.
Because with Urban II's speeches, he's talking about all kinds of atrocities that the Muslims are committing in Jerusalem against Christians, which in fact was not the case. And in fact, in Jerusalem, you had the three peoples of the faith living there peacefully in different sections because they each worked together because they all, based on their different beliefs, they had to work together. Now, there have been a sultan, I believe, early in the 1000s who had destroyed the Church of the Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And he had been mad and he did all kinds of other horrible things to a whole bunch of people. But after he had passed, the Muslim people actually tried to work with the Byzantines to rebuild the church as an act of trying to reconcile for what had happened previously. But in the West, you have Urban II, you know, basically talking about all these atrocities to pilgrims and to the Christians in Jerusalem, and we need to take back Jerusalem and make it holy again.
And he knew this was untrue. He was just saying it to get a big army assembled, apparently, right?
PR spin, right?
Yeah.
And it just, you know, the message, of course, you know, goes to a group of people who do not have the education level, right? Because you just don't have that at that point in time. So if you're just a regular person who has no education and the only education you get is from the church,
you've been trained from the very early age on to believe and obey what the church is telling you, and you got the leader of the whole church telling you these atrocities are happening, even though they aren't, that's a huge problem right there.
Yes, and one of the things that was an issue that in our current lifetime was a big issue was, if we remember George W. Bush,
yeah,
after 9/11 and his talk about reigniting the Crusades.
Yeah, and he used those words. Yeah, I know. So, I was flabbergasted when I heard that. I thought, because they're all trying to make the other side out to be these evil people calling for jihad, and then he makes that statement, basically saying the same thing. And so, in other words, he's doing what the Pope back then, Pope Urban, did. He's doing it right, yep, in our time.
And then, I mean, as we found out later on, how much of the information that we were supplied,
yeah,
was not accurate. And for the reason for going to war was not accurate. So,
yeah, supposedly weapons of mass destruction, which his own CIA told him weren't there, and he told him to go back and make sure that you find some evidence. In other words, whether you have to make it up or not.
and not even talking about the whole fact that the fact was Saddam Hussein was put in there at behest of the Americans originally because he would be a buffer between Iran.
Yes. Yeah. And no, it's so ironic.
So getting back to the whole idea is that the groups had actually lived peacefully. And then you bring about the Crusades, and now you have people wondering, well, why are people holding on to hundreds of years of hatred? Well, there's a reason for it. I'm not saying it's right, but you kind of have to understand the situation to see why there's a lingering distrust between. And it doesn't help when people are continually demonizing either side.
Right. And they're telling stories to their kids as they're growing up, because this is happening over the course of hundreds of years, as we said. And so the legend just grows, and the atrocities probably get told embellished, even although I don't know how you can embellish some of these atrocities are just awful. Going on in the name of religion on both sides.
Exactly. The interesting thing, too, is aside from just the religious issues, you look at, sadly looking at the fact that, like, the Western Europeans were not as advanced scientifically, mathematically as the Muslims. And you look at a lot of the lost knowledge that we don't have because of this whole situation. I mean, I guess it's human nature, but it's just sad when you think about that, right?
Yeah.
Of just how much was lost. And if they had just been able to come together and not have personal agendas and all this other stuff, maybe the situations we're in today wouldn't be quite the same.
Yeah, but even today, with the ISIS battles, and they're going into towns that are very historic and completely destroying some of the relics. So, it's still happening today.
Yes, and like as you say, like I've seen there's more temples in Palmyra, I think it was, that they found were destroyed. That were going back to Roman or even earlier times, because you think the Middle East, that area has been settled for thousands of years.
Yeah.
You've got thousands and thousands of years of history.
Thousands of years before Jesus, even.
Yes. And it's sad. And it's sad. And it's so sad to think of what is lost, because whether it's greed or profit or whatever the idea is, you're taking a message and so distorting it to the point where it's unrecognizable to whatever the intentional message was, right? And just like the crusade going, whether there was good intent or not from it, just see how it spiraled out and what it ended up causing. I wonder if Urban II had a chance, if he would have reconsidered what happened. Maybe not, because it's, again, a different time frame, but it seems if you took any basic religion, adjust the tenets of the religion, most of them have the same idea of working together, loving your neighbor, helping out, being a good person. Most of them do not talk about the first tenet to be go out and murder people.
Yeah, and it's okay if you do it in the name of religion.
As long as you do it in the name of your God,
yes.
That's okay. And, for instance, with the pogroms that happened in the Rhineland, with the Rhineland massacres, Count Emico, I think his name was one of these guys who claims God came to him and told him he had to murder the Jewish people because of the evil they had perpetrated on Jesus. But do any of these people remember the fact that Jesus was a Jewish person?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was Jewish. It's just, yeah, so anyways, but it's very interesting to see how the one message can get so distorted depending on who is telling and passing that message on.
Right, and Jesus would be the first person to tell them not to do such a thing in his name.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there'd be some head shaking going on for what happened, so.
So, okay, so we get the four main armies of the Crusaders just arriving in Constantinople, and I assume Alexius, then when he looks out over the horizon and sees all these armies coming, he's got to be a little surprised, I would think.
Well, and luckily they don't all come quite at once, so at least he can deal with them sort of successively, but he hears about them long before they arrive because of the havoc they cause making their way to Constantinople. His thing, though, is trying to get them to swear an oath that any territory that they recapture will be recaptured in the name of him and the Byzantine Empire and not going into business for themselves. And because the Byzantines are very ceremonial and very political, it's almost, that's why you get that, if you know, when people sometimes use Byzantine as like a derogatory comment, because that's a Western perspective, was that all the highfalutin arts and science of Constantinople was just, you know, wasn't manly. It wasn't true. And so it's just interesting that even today, you know, if you'll hear people say that kind of stuff, or they'll refer and not understand why they're like, there's that kind of negative connotation to it. And it's just that, but it's interesting because Alexius finally is able to get the different leaders of the groups to each swear the oath, and
all but one. Seth,
all but one, who manages to play his way out of it.
Yeah.
And so in the meantime, that he's before those four armies come, he's had to deal with the People's Crusade because they end up getting there first, right? And he has to basically shuffle them across the Bosphorus into Anatolia because you can't have 50, 60,000 people sitting outside your city and hope that good things will come from that. And so basically you have Peter the Hermit who gets his group across the Bosphorus and they attempt to storm through Anatolia as ill-prepared and, I'll just say ill-prepared.
Ill-equipped, yes. Ill-prepared, and they have women and children with them.
And basically it ends up that they get basically wiped out because they come up against a Turk group and basically get wiped out. There's a siege of a castle where they, part of this crusade had captured a castle in a town, except that it didn't have access to water in the castle. And it ended up that basically the Turks just laid a siege to the castle and ended up forcing the people to surrender. But you had a choice to either convert or die. And then if you converted, you were then sent into slavery, which is also interesting because that's against the tenets of Islam.
Yeah.
But which is funny because it's kind of brought up in another documentary from Terry Jones about the idea that no Muslim is supposed to enslave another Muslim, but the Seljuk Turks and the Christians didn't really know that. There's kind of jokes about. So
yeah.
So it ends up basically Peter the Hermit survives, but his crusade is basically decimated. And then that's when you get the other armies finally reaching Constantinople and then finally making their way across the Bosphorus and into Anatolia. And so the gentleman who's in control of that area on behalf of the Turks at the time, it's like, oh, it's just basically another bunch of rabble. We dispatched the first group pretty easily. These guys are not going to be anything more. Except these guys are actually the knights, and these are actually the soldiers.
So the People's Crusade actually kind of worked in a way as a ruse.
It's a great ruse, not as it intended, but
yeah,
it did. So you end up having, this time when they actually fight the real army, it's a, taking that almost like kind of lackadaisical approach. Well, I'm not too worried. It's just another bunch of these rabble, the Franks, as they call them, or the Rum, because they considered them the Romans, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. Yeah. So you end up having this time the actual crusaders basically end up starting to take out the other armies that they approach and meet and start taking cities in Anatolia back. The problem is that the cities themselves were still populated by Eastern Orthodox Christians. But they can't tell the difference between them and the Turks, the Muslims. So when they take the cities, they end up killing Christians. So they're killing their own people.
Yeah.
Because it ends up they then have to make their way through Anatolia, which itself is a very difficult terrain, especially when you get to the Taurus Mountains. And there's huge losses. People and supplies just because of how difficult the terrain is, and they're being harried by the Turks as the Turks continually get pushed back. And finally, they make their way through the mountains into the area, which is then occupied by the city of Antioch, which is the ancient city, and it's a city that is very important to the Christians. And that was one of the cities that Alexius was hoping to be able to have recaptured back in his name.
Now, this is all the way down into what is now Syria in that area. So they're all the way through.
Just on the border of Syria.
Yes.
And so they end up getting to Antioch, but Antioch is fabled for its walled defenses. And the Christians initially think that, you know, this is going to be a fairly easy siege. And they basically set up a siege around the city and end up basically not provisioning themselves properly, because by the time they get to Antioch, it's going to be the onset of winter and they don't realize that the winter there is going to be cold as well. They think it's going to be very temperate and pleasant.
Yeah.
And they end up basically going through all the resources of the area without thinking of needing to, you know, you're going to need to keep provisions because we don't know actually know how long the siege is going to take. And so it ends up that the siege goes months and months and months, and the Turkish battalions inside Antioch can launch little attacks here and there and harass the Christians, and the Christians end up having disease and all that kind of other stuff happening because you're basically stuck in the mud kind of thing, right? And so you have the situation where you start to having people demoralized and just all those kind of issues that you would deal with when you're trying to run a siege on a city that goes longer than you've ever prepared yourself for. Because by the time the Christians actually get to Jerusalem and actually conquer Jerusalem in July of 1099, you're looking at basically 5 years from when, almost 5 years from when Pope Urban II had actually came up with the idea of the crusade.
Yeah. Well, heck, I'd have a hard time doing that. Just walking from Europe to there nowadays.
Yeah,
let alone fighting and trying to survive.
Well, and exactly. And the thing is that when they get, you're coming out with, for the knights and the soldiers, basically, who went into huge debt to try and do this campaign, you're carrying all this heavy equipment in your horses. And by the time you're going through the mountains in Anatolia, if you lose half your equipment because you can't make it through safely, by the time you get to Antioch, the thousands of knights have now just become foot soldiers because they lost everything, right? And so you
can't
have,
carry it, their horses are dying. Yeah.
And the other thing was that the crusaders encounter is that when they're fighting the tactics of the Turks have this trick that they continually do on the Christians. Every time they do a battle, they do the feigned retreat, and the Christians never learn.
Yeah, they fall for it over and over again.
Over and over again. So, I mean, bit by bit, you're having your army whittle away. And then when you get to a point where you're having a siege and then you're losing more and more people because of disease and starvation, and because, I mean, you're not being able to feed your troops. And so it gets to the point where you even have characters like Peter the Hermit, who pops up again, actually trying to run away. And he ends up having to be brought back.
Oh, yeah.
And made to re-swear his oath to the crusade. And then you have a gentleman by the name of, don't remember if you know him or not, Stephen of Blois, or Blois, who he's known because of his letters written to his wife.
Yes.
Who was the daughter
William the Conqueror, was it?
William the Conqueror, exactly. Yeah. And so you have these like fanciful letters that he sends to his wife about how things are perfect and excellent and wonderful. And then finally it gets to the point where even he stops being as flowery, and he's like talking about how he's going to go home.
Wait, wasn't it that when they got to Jerusalem and they were...
That was outside of Antioch.
Oh, was that Antioch? And there was word that a large Turk army was on their way, and they were not yet in Antioch. And he decides, oh, I'm getting out of here. This is a no-win situation.
Cut my losses.
Yeah.
And the best part is that all during this period of time, the Crusaders are still arguing about who's going to get control of Antioch once they conquer it. And Bohemond, who's the southern Norman I mentioned earlier.
The one who didn't swear his allegiance necessarily to Alexius.
Because he'd been battling the Byzantines with his father, Roger, I believe it was, for years. So yeah, he was not going to swear fealty, and he was going to do anything to screw them over that he could.
Yeah, he did swear kind of half allegiance. He changed the wording, and it was all very, yeah.
It's kind of like, I'm swearing, but my fingers are crossed behind my back. And so it ends up, though, that he actually makes friends with a soldier who's within the garrison in Antioch. I think his name was Firouz. And basically makes a deal with him to allow the troops, the crusading troops, to actually enter Antioch.
Yeah, he's going to open up one of the gates at night for him. But before he does this, he wants to get the other leaders to agree that he would be the one that would be the leader of Antioch.
Exactly, because one of the gentlemen who is the eldest of the actual group, Raymond of Toulouse, who had been fighting the Muslims in Iberia, just thinks he should be getting any territory because he is the oldest. And so you have these different people fighting amongst each other just to try and get the territory. And it ends up that finally the Christians become so disheartened with how badly the siege is going.
And they hear that another army, Turk army, is on the way also. That probably helped a lot.
Exactly. So then you have a situation where they finally concede and say that, yes, we'll agree to Bohemond. If he can get into the city, then he'll get possession of it. And so then you end up having Bohemond make his deal with Ruse, and then end up, they successfully enter the city. And the ironic part, though, is that the morning that Bohemond's going to do this attack on Antioch, Stephen of Blois decides it's time to leave. And so he leaves the siege, taking his soldiers back with him, heads back to Constantinople and gets to Constantinople and tells them that, they're going to be all dead and don't bother sending reinforcements because there's another huge army coming towards Antioch. And it's just funny because that decision to do that caused a whole lot of mess for his fellow crusaders. And if he had just kept his mouth shut, or at least had said, you could still send help, it might make a difference. But anyways, and so it ends up for Stephen of Blois, he goes back in shame.
Yes, and that's what he's known about for the rest of time today.
So it didn't matter how much he did up to the siege, because he walked out on the siege on the day that they actually successfully took Antioch, he's always remembered as a coward.
And his wife was furious with him because she's, after all, William the Conqueror's daughter, and she likes brave people, and she just doesn't want to have anything to do with him.
And it's funny because he didn't really want to go to the start, so it kind of... So it ends up that he ends up having to go back after Jerusalem is actually captured, and he has to go with a group of people who basically were deserters.
Yeah, and, the first crusade. Well, his wife said, you have to do. Yeah. She basically made him like the scolding wife. You get back there holding her rolling pin, probably telling him, you're going back.
So it's just, it's interesting to have those little stories of like come up. So anyways, the Christian crusaders end up taking Antioch. And they just take back Antioch just in time for the Turkish force to arrive.
Yeah, they get safely inside, but now they're the ones being sieged and not the sieges.
But of course, when they get inside, again, they can't tell the difference between who's who, and so they basically end up massacring people, whether they be Christian or not, and they still end up having, I believe there's a citadel that was being controlled by the son of the guy who was actually the city was the patriarch of the city. So there's like a hard battle to try and get him out of the citadel and try to actually take the full city under control of the Latin Christians. And then when they do, then you have the Turkish force that's come together. And now keep in mind, this isn't a united force. This is a force of different cities because each of the cities within the Turkish sphere are their own, it's like their own city-states, right, basically? I guess that would be the best way to put it.
And several of those, or many of those, wouldn't even come to the aid of the others. I believe there were two Turk brothers that hated each other, and they wouldn't help each other.
And I think that the big leader, the big ringleader for this was Kerboga, I believe his name was.
Yeah.
And he was the gentleman who, basically, people started to realize that if we take this city back, he's just going to take it. And so it ends up that there's a situation where basically they're not as unified as the Christians basically see them to be because they don't understand the politics of the area. So in the meantime, you've gone from besieging Antioch for months to then you finally take Antioch, but now you're being besieged because basically the Turkish army moves in and now they're running a siege on you.
Right. And you're stuck in Antioch, which, as you said, they were laying siege to. So a lot of the supplies inside were probably whittled down to begin with.
Yeah. So all the wealth and all the provisions that they thought they had in Antioch, they didn't. And so then it was trying to find a way to, because there's, I believe there's a port city that was attached with Antioch or that Antioch used to try and get provisions. So it was like trying to keep that open and having to send raiding parties to try and go around the land to try and keep provisioning the city because you've got to feed all your soldiers. And then they're being harassed by the Turkish soldiers who are basically laying the siege. And again, the situation gets dire and the Christians end up having one of the fun parts of the Holy Relics coming up, where you have good old Peter the Hermit again coming up this time for having visions of the lance that speared Christ is supposed to be hidden within the church in Antioch. And so this whole idea of, again, that concept that there's all these holy relics all around, and if you can get a hold of these holy relics, they will help you be blessed by God and have victory. And so there's this whole situation where Peter the Hermit is claiming he's having these visions and ends up supposedly finding the lance that supposedly pierced Christ within the church. And so this is supposed to be used as a sign that God is still with them. And even though they've been punished for some of the stuff that they had, and like at one point during the siege of Antioch, they sent all the women away from the camp because, of course, in those times, women were considered the root of all evil, and God was punishing them and for not taking Antioch because they had women in the camp. So just one of those other wonderful times back in there.
But when he pulls out the Holy Lance, it does make everyone think. They really buy into it. They think, well, we can't be beat now.
So then, yeah, so it gets the morale up and it ends up that they decide that they're going to have to basically try and do an attack on the forces besieging them because they can't hold out for much longer. And so it ends up that at the same time that they're deciding to do their attack, the Turkish troops and the Turkish different groups within the Turkish army basically decide that they've had enough with it and they don't want to, you know, help Kerboga be able to increase his wealth at their cost. And so basically you have this situation where on the one hand, the Christian army talks about how they sent their soldiers or their knights out to fight the Turkish forces. And then the visions of the dead come and end up helping them beat off the Turkish army and free them and save them. And so you have all this going on. And then you have in reality, the Turkish groups basically getting fed up, seeing that there's nothing to benefit them individually and just deciding to pull out. And so it was just interesting where you have those spins.
The individual factions of the Turks, as you said, that, well, they wouldn't mind getting into a fight with the Christians, but they're not going to get back this city to turn it over to one of their rivals. So you're right.
Right.
Just like Stephen did, some of them are thinking, well, it's not worth it. We're going to head out.
And the interesting part, too, is that, again, because as I talked about before, you have the Turkish, the Seljuk Turks, but you also have the Fatimids who were in Egypt. And they're the ones who actually have control of Jerusalem. And at this point, all they think that the Christians are doing is just basically trying to take back and raid some of these cities. They don't understand that the main actual goal is to go and actually take back Jerusalem. So you actually have, during the siege of Antioch, the Egyptian group actually sending an envoy, an ambassador, and they actually are dealing with the Christians.
Right. And the Egyptians were Muslims, as you said, but they were the Shiite Muslims.
Right.
And the Seljuks were Sunni, so they were actually at odds with each other, too.
So it's basically like the idea between the Eastern and Western Christian churches,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I'm sure people recognize those terms, Shiite and Sunni Muslims. Even today, they're still battling.
Yes, and I mean that it's very important to kind of understand, because the mess in the stuff, for instance, in Iraq, where you're pitting the different religious groups against each other and putting each other in power against each other, you're only causing more trouble. Yeah. And that's part of why we have so many issues, or we've had so many issues with even today, Iraq is still a mess. And I feel for those people there, because none of them asked that to happen.
Right.
Right. But it's the whole idea where the West doesn't try to understand, maybe, or they just, whatever it happens, where they don't understand the differences, and those continual mistakes continue to compound on each other. And it's, for instance, if you look at with World War I, when the British take back Jerusalem from the Ottoman Turks, it's the whole thing where they start cutting up the land with these fake borders without an understanding or concept of who the actual people are within the borders. And it's not just one group of people. You have groups of people who are living within that area. And then you start, just without thought or without understanding, creating these borders, and you're just making more of a mess. But it's that whole Western idea where, I guess going back to even imperialism, where it's like, this is the way it is because this is how we see it. And I mean, you can see that in the sense of the crusade, where it goes back to the crusades, where it's the Western outlook. It doesn't look to embrace an alternative idea that may in fact be a better idea. It's, this is the way we see it, so this is how it is.
Right.
So it's just very interesting that, and this is, for me being a history nerd or whatever, the idea of where the more you read about history, the more it's very important that you understand it. And I know a lot of people, like I think we talked about with when we were doing the Pompeii Herculaneum episode, that history is done so dry and so uninteresting, people hate it. But the thing is that if you don't understand it, then you're going to continue to make the same mistakes.
Yeah, that's where they get the adage, history repeats itself. You're right. But this, I don't see how anybody could not be interested in hearing about this, because it, as we've alluded to a couple times already, it's still going on today. These same people are there, and they're having the same problems. And so you might get an understanding of what is going on over there right now by learning about what happened over 1,000 years ago.
Exactly. And the interesting part is, it plays such a huge part in where we are. It just such a huge part. And as I say, I mean, everybody's got different passions and different things that they're interested in. That's awesome. But I just wish that there's a better presentation. And maybe it's just, that's the intention, is that you just make it so the idea, it's almost the Orwellian idea, right? Where you just give people just enough, but not too much information, because information is power.
But that is the issue here. There's so much information. And what makes it interesting, at least for me, is when you start learning about the different personalities, it really brings it to life. And you start thinking, instead of just learning dates and names of places they went and did this and that without knowing the individuals involved, when you start learning about the individuals, just as an example that I can think of, and this would have been way later, this would have been during the Third Crusade with Richard.
Right, King Richard the Lionheart, yeah.
Yeah, and Saladin. And at one particular battle, King Richard, who was a very great and brave fighter, and that he actually came with just, like 50, 60 men to defend one of the cities that they were sacking, that the Turks were sacking. And Saladin was there, and he was watching as his little group of 60 knights came on shore and started defending it. And they actually repelled them back into the city. And at one point, his horse got shot out from under him, King Richard. And Saladin was actually ordered his men to take him a replacement horse. He had that much respect for him fighting that he wanted him to have a horse back.
Well, it's interesting too, like, as you know, whether we get into it now or later, the that thing exactly of Saladin was, to most historians or European historians, right, is very respected. He's a figure that the Europeans have venerated as the epitome of chivalry in how he conducted himself with the Europeans. Because later on, I'm not sure if you've heard about it, there's a gentleman by the name of Baybars, who basically no one really wants to talk about, because he basically was what led to the end of the Crusades, at least in the Crusades in the Middle East, because he basically wiped out the Christian footprint there. And he was, whereas Saladin was, he was like kind of like the philosopher warrior, Baybars was, he was straight warrior. And it's kind of one of the things that they talk about, and I've kind of read about, where there's the idea that the West will venerate Saladin because they see him as someone to point to the Muslim people, as someone to look up to, because he worked with the Europeans. But we don't really want to talk so much about Baybars, because he basically kicked our butts.
Yeah.
And would have nothing to do with us, because he's had issues with how we were, kind of, or, you know, as a, the group was, as a people. So it's, again, one of those things where it's interesting, where see, when you start to get all these different personalities and to see who gets remembered more based on who's writing the history.
Right.
And the interesting part with the Crusades is that, you know, you have, you don't just have the Christian story of it. Like, I mean, the West is going to promote, is more based in the Christian side, but you actually have the Muslim side of it. So you actually have their side talking about what is happening, and like these incursions from the Franks or the Rum, and just talking about the differences in the people, and just, you know, basically as how the Greeks and the Romans saw the Germanic and the tribes that weren't within their sphere of as what they considered acceptable, barbarians. So basically the Western Europeans come about basically as barbarians to the Muslims, because the Muslims, you know, are far more advanced in science, in mathematics, and they basically see this rabble of people that they don't seem to understand, and they don't understand their motivations. And it's just very interesting when you get into all the, like, the different dynamics of that, and being able to actually have the other side, because usually in the story, we only get one side of the story.
Yes. And when the Muslim people, even today, when they say that the word crusade is a buzzword for them, I mean, it's really bad. They remember what happened. And as you said, when our president, George W. Bush, used that exact word, it really scared them. And they realized what was at stake then. They thought the same thing was going to happen. And so that's why it's so careless for some leaders today to say something like that. It's just crazy. Much like jihad, when they use the word jihad, and I think nowadays if people hear that, they think the same thing. That's not good. That means they're calling on all Muslims to go against all Westerners.
And it's funny because, I mean, I'm sure if you know different people, there are good people and there are bad people in every religion. And to say that all Muslims are bad because there's an extremist is wrong. And to look at what happened to Muslim people and is happening to Muslim people today, where they're all being blacklisted because of a handful of extremists. How would the Christian people like it if they were all just one group, that's it, and because you guys did the Crusades, you're all evil, yeah. Right? I mean, like, if you want to look into the history of Christianity or different breakdowns, how many atrocities have they look at the Spanish Inquisition and the witch burning, the witch trials and the witch burning, all that kind of stuff. How many of those atrocities were completed in the name of God?
Yeah, I think when it doesn't. More, I believe more people were killed in the name of God than in any, for any other reason.
And it's sad because an idea that at its base is a good idea of being good to your neighbors and being a good person and having faith are all good ideas, but it's when they get so twisted. And I mean, you look even in the media stuff today where you're looking at people looking, you know, with this stuff with Trump and how basically you've had almost it's almost a feeling of fascism, and that the Nazis were in World War II. So it's we're not even 100 years away from World War II, and we've already had fascism rise up again, and people actually embracing the idea of fascism, and that you have this whole thing where it's just like these, especially if you look like at the KKK or whatever, where they're good Christians. They see themselves as good Christians.
Yeah.
And it's like, what part of the message of love your brother are you missing? There's nothing in there where Jesus, or at least, you know, that I'm familiar with, that says Jesus says go around and enslave everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Go around and mistreat everyone because they have a different color of skin or they have a different belief than you. I thought, you know, again, the idea was that you embrace your brother, whether you agree with them or not. And it's just funny that we're in the 2017 and we're getting again to that point where you're having these same issues. And again, it's being in God's name is being thrown around. And it's just, it's again, people not understanding or choosing not to understand. I don't know what it is, but it's just, again, that whole idea of the message getting so completely warped or corrupted from what originally it was. And it's just interesting to see that 1,000 years after the fact, we're going through the same stuff again.
Yeah, exactly. It's history is repeating itself because we obviously aren't learning our mistakes along the way. I think, we could talk about that.
Yeah, maybe. That's a whole other thing, but... But it's just interesting. But I guess getting back on topic, because I'm so bad about going off on tangents, and I apologize.
It's okay.
So basically the Crusaders end up having Antioch in their control, and then Bohemond actually gets control of Antioch for himself. So he basically leaves the Crusade because he's done. He's got his city. So then you have the rest of the Crusaders kind of spending time, because they basically took Antioch, and I think it was 1098. So they basically take Antioch, and then the rest of the group has to decide what they're going to do next, because the people who are there to retake Jerusalem are still saying, we haven't taken Jerusalem back. What are we doing? And one of the controversies that occurs during this period of time is, if you read about Murat al-Nun.
Yes.
And whether or not the Crusaders in their siege and taking of that city committed cannibalism?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest atrocities of all time, I would say. But they were in that situation when they actually broke in, they just massacred everybody, and I think it was like almost 2 weeks later when they started to turn to the dead bodies of people there and started to cook them up.
And so this is one of the interesting things, because it's the Christian side that talks about the actual cannibalism. From what I was reading, the Muslims don't really talk about this, so there's kind of a question as to whether or not this actually took place, because usually the Muslims are very good about documenting with the different events, right? So this is one of those events where they're not quite sure if it actually took place.
Right.
But
I could see them not talking about it if it's just so unbelievable that maybe you just don't even want to.
Yeah, plus there's going to be other atrocities down the road that they will have more than enough time to write about, so that's another thing.
Yeah.
So it ends up, though, that basically the Christians finally make their way to Jerusalem. Now, again, Jerusalem is, as we know, thousands of years old, because it's been of resettlement and settlement, and they've got huge, thick defensive walls, and again, very good defenses.
Yeah, like I think they're like 50 feet tall and 10 feet thick, something like that.
And so then you end up having a situation where now the Christian force again has to commit a siege. And this time they're doing it. It ends up being into the summer that the siege is taking place. And they end up having a bit of luck because they get some help from some other European forces that come in and provide them with wood and material so they can build siege towers. And there's an event that they talk about where before they actually take the city of Jerusalem, the camp was feeling so, just the morale was so bad that they end up basically walking barefoot around Jerusalem, around the city walls of Jerusalem, as a penance to try and ask for God's forgiveness.
Yeah.
And there's also a situation where Peter the Hermit comes up for his last time, because as we talked about kind of with his divining with the lance of that speared Christ, the Holy Lance, he has another situation where he's basically talking big and basically supposed to walk across hot coals.
Oh, yeah.
And because he has God's protection, he's going to get through the coals. And the does not end so well for him.
Yeah, there's a couple of versions to that story.
The version that he ends up severely burning himself and ends up dying a few days after the fact. And then there's a story that he made it through the hot coals perfect. And then he just something else happened to him.
Yeah, well, they got so upset with him that they killed him.
Yeah.
Because they thought he was pulling a fast one on him again. Because there were rumors back when he got pulled that Holy Lance out underneath Antioch that he had put it there first. And he knew it was going to be there. So,
yes, and I think it was Bishop Adhemar was the gentleman who he had great conflict with in around the period of Antioch, because Adhemar kind of saw him to be maybe the charlatan he might have been and had questioned him. And it ended up that Adhemar during the siege of Antioch passed because they weren't sure. There was one of the diseases they thought it could be maybe typhoid or something was going around, and he ended up dying of it, which was one of those huge morale blows that they had. Peter the Hermit decided to say that Adhemar had come to him in a vision, in a dream, and had told him he had gone to hell because he didn't believe Peter the Hermit. And this whole story he spun, and it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, he was he was a silver-tongued BSer, I think.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
And they kind of were starting to catch on. So either way, he either burned up in the coals and died, or he made it through and they discovered somehow that he did something. He had it fixed somehow to make it look like he made it through when he actually didn't. They figured it out and they just jumped on him and killed him.
They were just kind of done with his stuff. So. Yeah. But it was interesting. So then we finally get to the point where the Crusaders actually do their attack on the walls of Jerusalem, because they've got their siege towers built and they go through a very difficult battle taking Jerusalem.
Well, I think there was a key event the night before, though, because they had, as you said, the two siege towers for the whole city. So there's two, and they're basically these big wooden towers on wheels that are, you can walk up and get to the top, and you'd be at the top of the wall of Jerusalem, so you could get over. And
yes.
So one of them, and I forget who the general was that...
good old Raymond.
Raymond, yeah. So he kind of came up with a brilliant idea, because everybody inside Jerusalem is looking, and they've got all the supplies and ready to defend them right next to where these siege towers are. Well, in the cover of darkness at night, he had his men completely take it apart and move it.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking of Raymond's mistake, because he refused to take his siege tower apart.
Oh.
So it was Geoffrey of de Bouillon who actually had that idea of taking apart the siege tower and then putting up another part of the wall that was a weaker spot.
Yes. Okay, so
my apologies.
Yeah.
And then it was Raymond who refused.
Yeah, and his got and completely destroyed.
He got
right
destroyed.
Away. They had, I don't know, did they have Greek fire there, or they had something and they started it on fire and it burned right away?
Yeah, it just basically burned and destroyed his tower. And so all the work that he had done, that they had done for his tower and it was just a mess. And it was just another one. He was like one of those figures where it's like everything he did, because another one of the things in the backstory of Raymond was that every time they had a big battle, he always ended up being sick. So he always missed the battle.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like this thing that even, again, he, I think, has a higher belief of himself than was the reality. And it was, I think it was Jeffrey de Bouillon who had the idea of you take apart the siege tower, move to another spot, and surprise them because they didn't expect it. And then they successfully breached the wall and entered Jerusalem. And then, like, they actually, I think they talk in the Chronicles that there was actually the atrocities that occurred in Jerusalem were basically having the streets running with rivers of blood.
Yeah, it got pretty nasty, I'm sure.
People had gone into different, the mosques or whatever, and were asking for, or paying to be let go. And basically the Crusaders took the money and just murdered them anyways.
Yeah, it's awful when you think about it. Just terrible. But now the Christians have Jerusalem back at the end of the First Crusade.
So they have it. And the interesting thing is that I believe Pope Urban II passed away before
he had died.
He never got news that they actually took back Jerusalem.
He was alive when they took back Jerusalem, but it took news 2 weeks to get back, and in that 2 weeks he had died. Yes.
He had died, so he died never knowing that they actually had met his goal. And in the meantime, then you have Alexius, who's basically watched what used to be Byzantine territory, you know, over a period of time, basically now become all different principalities for the different crusading leaders.
Yeah. Yes, because one of them, even who, I forget who this was now, he had a wealthy wife, an influential wife who was very wealthy. She had died on the trip.
Was it Baldwin?
I think you're right. I think Baldwin. It was Baldwin. And so,
he was the younger brother of Jeffrey de Bouillon, and he was very much out for territory. Yeah. And when Jeffrey took control of Jerusalem and was named, they wanted to name him the King of Jerusalem. He wouldn't take the name. He didn't want to be, because he said the only king was Christ. But when he ends up dying, Baldwin comes in and becomes, he has no problem becoming King of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So it's interesting just the differences between the brothers.
Yeah, but when his wife passed away during the march towards Jerusalem, at that point, he knew that her kids were going to get all of her wealth, and he was kind of cut out. So he immediately turned and went towards a nearby city to take it for himself. You know, now the crusade part's over. I don't care so much about Jerusalem. And he did that.
Yes, that's the whole story of Edessa and how he basically came in as the protector, basically overthrew the guy who brought him in. Yes. And then he took the town.
Yeah. Had him adopt him.
Had him adopt him posthumously.
And then he, at least he knew about a conspiracy to take that king out. And he either did nothing or he actually helped him.
Yes. There's that question of just how much he was involved in having that death just happen beneficially for him. So it's very interesting to see, just again, we're not supposed to look back at history and look back from our and look at those days with our values, but sometimes it's hard because you're looking at some of the actions of people that don't seem to be aligned with what is purported. So, but it's just another one of those funny little adventures that they come up with. So
I wanted to go a little bit past the First Crusade because of the fact that we've talked so much about on other podcasts about the Knights Templar, referring to them in many different podcasts. And they basically started up right after this period of when the First Crusade ended in the early 1100s. And So they were a group that it was the idea of, was it, I can't remember his name now, Dupuy?
I forget how to pronounce his name. But yeah, his idea was to come up with an order to protect the pilgrims and to protect Jerusalem for the Christians. And that's basically where he comes up with the idea, or they first kind of appear, I think it was 1124. And then Bernard of Clairvaux ends up becoming a huge proponent of the Knights Templar and actually gets the papal bull enacted, which I think was 1134. And then that's when they become an official order of the church. And then they get what used to be on the Solomon's Temple. They get the mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque that was there built at that time, and they get access to that. And then that's where you get into the whole question of, did they get into the Solomon's Temple and find secrets that the church was trying to hide, or gave them what would be their power base?
Yeah, well, they were actually given that area of shelter right in the Temple of Solomon, and where many, you know, there were rumors that the Ark of the Covenant was there, and you know, many other artifacts such as that, and they may have found something, or maybe not, who knows, but that's where all of this legend of the Knights Templar stems from, that they would have had access to the area where these relics supposedly were, and who knows what they could have found.
Right, and then you get this whole situation where you start getting people becoming or wanting to be part, whether it's the Knights Templar or any of the other groups that were set up by the church, you know, because there's also other different groups that were set up, not just the Templars, but that were set up to protect the pilgrims and to provide hospice services or hospital services, medical services for people.
Yeah, the Hospitallers were one, and they they were actually formed before the Knights Templar.
The Knights Templar, right.
They were just kind of having hospitals and as places where pilgrims could come for aid if they had injuries or whatever on their way to the pilgrims. And then they saw what the Knights Templar were doing, and they thought, you know, that looks like a good idea. Maybe we should do that too.
And then you have the situation where they become an elite force because you get the best fighters, or you get all the wealth, because when you become a Knights Templar, you give up your wealth, right? When you take your vow of poverty and chastity and stuff.
Yeah, you give up everything.
You give up everything, and then you become a knight. And so then you have like this base. It's almost, you know, I guess in today's terms, you'd consider look at like Navy SEAL group kind of thing or something like that, right? Where it's like they're a specialized group.
Yeah, and they were well respected by the people because they were, number one, protecting them if they wanted to go to Jerusalem along the way. And also, they were given redemption if they contributed to the Knights Templar. They didn't even have to join them if they just gave them whatever they could, property, money, whatever. They got redemption that way. So the Knights Templar became a very rich organization, and they kept adding on. They were able to add on, and they became, I would call them a corporation, wouldn't you?
Excuse me, yeah, because then you get into the whole situation where they start doing the banking and providing the banking services to all the peoples of Europe. And so then you get to the point, as you talked about before, where you get to, they get, where the crusading, or at least the Middle Eastern crusades, have basically waned at the beginning of the 1300s. And then you get, says it, Prince King Philip.
Yeah.
I just wanted to
mention that the Knights Templar too were they got a lot of land that was donated to them by people.
Yes.
And so they turned that into farming land. They produced in the Holy Land products that they were selling in Europe. That one of them being sugarcane. They went crazy for sugar. They
exactly.
only had honey before. They had cloth. They were making cotton. And gauze.
And then you had the spices and things that the Europeans weren't used to or weren't familiar with. So you had the spices being part of the trade.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is that, and this is just, you know, not even just with the Templars, but the whole thing when the knights and the nobles financed their crusading, they gave up property to the church. So you have the church acquiring vast amounts of land for financing what they initially started. So you, and that's where you have the church getting so much different property across Europe. And to, for these, because what they talk about is that it was like a, your like life's investment to go on crusade. Yeah. So you basically get your, you know, so you're getting all this wealth and property is going to the church. So what is the church going to do with it? And that's where you also have the whole situation with the fight between the church and the kings as right. to who has authority over the church and the people, and where you get the leader of the Holy Roman Empire bringing in a pope and having like the anti-pope and the, you know, this whole battle where trying to do just decide who actually has final say over yeah. stuff. And the Crusades end up being that point where the church takes that authority yes. until you get the point where you get to Martin Luther and such, where you start getting the Reformation and the whole fight against the power of the Latin or the Catholics.
Right. And then in the early 1300s, one of those kings, as you said, King Philip of France, apparently he owed a vast amount of money to the Templars.
And the whole idea of that, how he basically strong-armed the Pope at the time to break up the Templars and destroy the Templars because he didn't want to have to pay them back. And he basically saw that as a, like an opposing power to him. And just it's, so you get end up getting the situation where, you know, where we get Friday the 13th is a bad day.
Right.
It was bad luck because that was the day that he sent his forces, his to basically wipe out the Templars in France.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened.
And then, yeah, then you have the stories of did he get all of the Templars, and some Templars escaped. And then you have the stories of basically the Templars going to areas like Portugal that were friendly to the Templars.
Yeah.
And they basically created a new order, just a different name.
Right, and they knew now, and, you know, everybody wonders about that and, you know, the secrecy of those kind of organizations and even the Freemasons who may or may not have a connection and all the way back to the Knights Templar. But, well, you can see why you'd want to have that organization become a secret organization once they send out execution orders on everyone.
Yeah. When you... And it's funny because it's, again, one of those things where it's like you got too powerful. Even if you hadn't intended it, you got too powerful and people don't like you, so they're going to take you down.
Yeah, why do you just owe too much money or one guy owes too much money to you and that one guy is powerful enough that he can do something about it. And it's not a good situation.
And he does. And there's the whole horrible things that he committed against the Templars that he captured to force them to confess. Then they redacted their confessions and then they were put to death. And just not a great time. And then of course, you know, later on leading into the Inquisition and all the stuff that happens from that. But the interesting thing about the Crusades is that we were talking mostly about the Middle Eastern Crusades. But you've got all the other different kinds of crusades against, for instance, like Germanic tribes in the north that are still paganistic. And so you have these different crusades against them that, yeah. you know, pop up later. And just, again, that whole thing of basically the church trying to stamp out any opposition or alternative ideas. And... You know, not until you get to the point where you start getting the Renaissance, where you start being able to have new ideas embraced and challenging the church, the power of the church. And it's interesting how much the church became such a political entity as opposed to just providing faith. It became so much more. And the Crusades played a huge part in that. And whether or not that was the intention from Urban II at the start, it sure got taken that way.
Yeah.
By the success of people that followed, right?
Right. So, right. And it continues on.
And then you
in
look
one
at the,
form or another.
Exactly. And then you look at the exchange and the improvements, a lot of the improvements that Western Europe would have because of the adventuring ends up leading to the city states like Venice and Genoa becoming forces later on in the Middle Ages as trading sources, right? And opening up the Mediterranean unlike it had been before. And, you know, so, I mean, it changed really changed the course of history in different ways, whether they be good or bad or both. And it's just such an interesting topic because there's so much you could read about it. And the fact that you can read, as I say, both sides and get a little bit more of a less skewed idea, because I mean, you know, for most of the time when we're reading stuff, it's only getting one side or what's purported from one side. You always have the one side story, the other side of the story, but and then what's the truth in the middle? And at least this way you can kind of compare to see what is closer to the truth.
Yeah.
In that process.
Well, that's why it's fun talking about this, because instead of just reading the traditional history of it as it's told to us, dates and names and that and what happened. And here you can kind of, if you delve into it further, you can kind of at least get, as you said, more of the true information and decide for yourself what, if you think that's really the true story or not. And most of the time, it's not really the true story. As we've said before, history is written by the victors and it's not necessarily the accurate description of it.
Exactly. And then being able to see the true stems of what ended up would end up being the Holocaust with World War II, to see those first steps being, you know, from the First Crusade and onward, and just see just how that was justified by the people at the time. And I mean, yes, you had people, and there's stories of church members trying to protect the Jewish people and, you know, being attacked for it. Yeah. Because these groups, the zealots or whatever you want to put it, get so inflamed that they're just, you know, this is the way it is. And taking that message again and just spinning so far from what the original message was supposed to be and whether that message should have happened in the first place.
Yeah.
So the other interesting part, too, is when you look at just the fact of what the Western Europeans picked up in regards to building castles and such, because they learned a lot picking up tricks from the whether it's the Turkish Muslims or the Fatimids in technology wise, so that they like spring forward much further than what if they just stayed in their areas, right? So in a sense that exchange of knowledge. You wish it could have been a more peaceful exchange of knowledge, but
right, could have been.
So it's just it's such a fascinating topic, and I say if someone is really interested or considering it, like Sharon Eastall's podcast is fantastic, The History of the Crusades, or if you can go on YouTube or if you can find a copy on Amazon or something of Terry Jones' Crusades series. He does it's about 3 hours, 3 hour series, and it's just fantastic.
Right.
Great job that he does on that. And it's just maybe getting a chance to kind of open your perspective on it and see kind of that a lot of that's happening today does stem back from that period. And now you can have an understanding why, because I think with North Americans, we have because we haven't been around that long. Aside from the Native Americans, of course, who were here many, many hundreds of years before us, we don't have that same sensibility that they do in Europe or the Middle East, where you are living in history. So your history is always with you. And so things that happened hundreds of years ago are going to resonate with you because they're carried on to you. Whereas here, because we haven't built that and we have a much different outlook, I think, and maybe I could be totally wrong on this, but this is how it feels, is that we have a much different outlook on things, that we are very much more short term and we don't look back so much on the past, and that we don't, so we have a hard understanding of why people hold grudges for so long.
I was just thinking of back in, well, it was after this period, I think there was the great Chinese explorer, Zheng He was his name, and this would have been in the, I don't know, late 1300s, 1400s, somewhere in there, where they started sending out these ships, and they actually supposedly came as far as Italy, and were sharing their knowledge and some of their goods and that sort of thing. But then suddenly, sometime after that, the leader of China closed everything down, destroyed the ships. He didn't want to have anything to do with the outside world. And I don't remember why he thought that exactly, but I'm starting to think that if they visited and saw what the heck was going on and how people were treating each other in the name of religion and that, maybe he thought, well, I'm pulling everything back. I don't want to have contact with them.
And that's interesting too, because you look at even before that time, there's talk that the Romans had trade with the Chinese and that they actually had interactions. So, I mean, it's, again, you have all these different peoples from all these different lands, and you have one narrative that everyone kind of kept to themselves or were so, sheltered to a certain area. But once you start reading this and things start coming out, and you start to realize that there was a lot more contact than we maybe have been taught or were taught in school. And I mean, that could even go back to the situation with Columbus, right? I mean, yes. You look today and a lot of Americans still say that Columbus discovered America.
Yeah. Well, but, we talked about that several times. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's funny that a lot of people realize that's not the case, but that's still the story that's told.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible that. I mean, we've even found a lot of evidence that of the the Vikings and other groups that war had to have been here. And yet, yeah, that's still the traditional story.
And I mean, you've got suggestions that the Phoenicians made their way to the New World.
Yeah.
And I mean, considering they were the greater, one of the greater maritime nations, it's quite possible that they did. And then you get to the whole situation of how do all these different cultures end up having similar ideas or similar things pop up? Like, do they just all just coincidentally happen to happen? Or is there, a greater understanding, or was there more contact than we to this point have been told?
Yeah, well, and there is also talk that the guy I mentioned, the Chinese explorer Zheng He, actually made it all the way to North America in the Mediterranean area. So it would have been a lot easier for them to get here.
So it's so interesting. And this is the beauty, I think, with history, and at least being in our time as we are, that we have so much access to information. Now, it also takes time to vet it because, there's also disinformation as well. But we are so lucky to have the level of access to information that we do. When you consider even a couple hundred years ago, that there was, the information was kept by a small group of people. It wasn't widely available to the masses. And I mean, there's a reason why it was that way. Yeah. So it's just, to be able to look now and be able to look with a hopefully more objective eye to what has happened and to be able to question and say, just because this is the narrative I was told doesn't mean this is actually what happened.
Right.
And I think that's a really awesome thing. And I think, I credit you and Chuck for coming and being a force in the podcast verse, for giving an option and an ear for people to have an alternative idea. and to be able to talk about things that most people, if you say something, they just look at you like you're crazy, or they make fun of you, or, you know, being able to be open and be able to say that, you know, there is way far more things in this world than we can ever conceive or hope to understand. And then it's the human arrogance that we know all and science or religion explains everything.
Right.
And I think, so like, it's a credit to you guys for all the work that you've done to be able to give a voice to people like myself who want to think outside the box. And I think being able to touch on these different topics that most people won't touch. And you do it in a respectful and positive way where it's not, you may not agree with the full topic or idea with different points of it, but you're not out to disrespect others. And I think that's an awesome thing that you and Chuck have done, and you've continued with, you know, Chuck stepping to the side. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. And also thank you very much for talking with me today about the Crusades. It's been a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed it as well.
Yes, hopefully, and hopefully you get that fire lit to look into things, whether it's, even if it's not this topic, something else, and just embrace that and take that.
Yeah, just look at anything that interests you in history and that you may not know much about, and start to pick at it a little bit and really get into the details, and I think you'll be hooked.
Exactly.
All right, well, for more on this and other topics, you can visit our website at mysterioustopics.com. Thanks again, Sean.
Thanks, John.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Goodbye.